So welcome everyone. Are there people here who are here for the first time? Just raise your hand. Okay. So for those of you here from the first time, there's a Dharma talk, and often the Dharma talk is on a specific subject or a commentary on certain teachings of the Buddha or one of the masters, teachers of the lineage. But over the summer, a little more relaxed, and I'm just dealing with different topics that have come up recently. But we always like to begin with an opportunity for people to ask any questions you have. And this asking of questions means whether you're brand new today or whether you've come for a while, it's important that the teachings be something that's alive and relevant. And so therefore, if you have any questions about the practices that were done here this morning, or anything you saw or observed this morning, or as much in your own attempts through your own study or practice or readings or surfing the internet, if you have any questions about what these things mean, or most significantly, how do I bring these teachings and practices into my life? So the transformative promises of the teachings and practices can be realized and manifested in one's own life. That's most important. So please don't be shy. If anybody has any questions about practice or teachings, I'm open to it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I recently studied on a workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, in the workshop, they talked about anger as a toxic thing that happens to us. But I was wondering, the Buddha also talks about seeds of anger. Is anger something part of our habit? Forming negative habit forming energies, or is it something that is born in us, like this idea of seeds?
Oh, okay. So the question is, I'm just repeating for the recorder, is in terms of anger. On the one hand, at a recent workshop, anger was referred to as a kind of a toxic emotion. But at the same time, there's what's mentioned of seeds. Seeds in the consciousness, seeds in the mind, and anger, and the seeds of anger. And does that imply that, that there are these indigenous seeds that all of us have of anger, or other types of afflictive emotions? So they're really the same thing. The idea of seeds, which is part of kind of Buddhist psychology, is that the residue of all our experiences, which means our experiences from birth onward, the residue of our experiences become seeds that are in our what are called our storehouse consciousness, our alaya vijnana, where all the seeds of our experience are stored. That is why we have memories. We can remember things. But at a deeper level, it also means that we have all these positive and negative seeds. Seeds of anger and jealousy and fear and judgment and criticism and worthlessness, all those. But we also have seeds of patience and kindness and compassion and understanding and lightness and happiness. And so we have all these various seeds, that we all have, because we've all grown up under various conditions, and that in our relationship, how we've related to our experiences have created a multitude of positive and negative seeds within us. And in terms of how we then look at these seeds, Right. We would say that some are positive, some are negative. Some are enhancing and some are toxic. But that relates to really kind of the relationship of these seeds to our minds, right? And whether these, the experience of these various types of emotions, which ones create a sense of well-being, of harmony, of happiness, of lightness, of openness, and which of those seeds, in this case, of these emotions, let's say, that create the opposite. Create conflict, create a sense of constriction, ill at ease, that in their manifestation and relationship they cause suffering. Right? So the classifying seeds as positive and negative is really how it affects the mind state and how it affects the actions. Is that clear? But the ground is not, the ground receives the seeds and the ground holds the seeds. But the ground of our mind is seedless. Right. That is why we could say that Buddhist psychology is so positive, because there's nothing inherent, right, in us. So even though you may say, I've always been an angry person, let's say, or I've always been a fearful person, or I've always been a sad kind of person. What we would say is, that is not your true nature. That is not your true mind. But those are the seeds that were planted and have been planted during the course of our life. And those are the seeds that have been nurtured. And seeds that are nurtured, just like in horticulture, seeds that are nurtured, they will grow, right? And whether we call some seeds beautiful and desirable, and whether we call some seeds growing into plants that are noxious and ugly, depending on how we look at these things, that has to do with how they develop. But they all began as seeds. But knowing that, right? Knowing that intrinsically these seeds have no permanent basis, that's very optimistic, because it says, even if because of causes and conditions and my own ignorance of what was going on within my mind and body, I have nurtured these kind of seeds within myself, I can stop. And not only can I stop nurturing them, so they stop growing the way they've always grown, but I can begin to nurture a wholly different repertoire of seeds, right? And that is really, I think, what spiritual practice is about. It's about becoming conscious. In other words, for most of us, we've been unconsciously given seeds. Seeds in our family, seeds in our environment, seeds in our schools. So, and we didn't know better, so we just kind of continued on planting seeds and nurturing seeds without really understanding what the effects would be. Right. But when one embraces a spiritual path, one really becomes more conscious in this sort of way and understands clearly, these seeds that I have been nurturing, which are manifesting in a whole range of ways of thinking, mind states, feeling states, ways of interacting with people, relating, I can understand now they produce suffering, or they don't produce the well-being that I seek. So I want to stop doing them, stop nurturing them. At the same time, I want to begin to nurture a whole other repertoire that will produce a whole different sort of mind. Right, and a way of relating, and that's what that's what spiritual practice is about. That's what following a spiritual path is about. It's a path of transformation. Is that it? Is that what you were getting at? Yeah. Any other questions? Don't be shy. Yes.
I have a question about non-attachment.
Yes.
So, I'm having this discussion with my husband, and we're both confused about it.
And you both what?
We're both confused about it.
Good.
So I find your attachment useful when it's a negative emotion or something or it's easy to not attach to material objects.
For some people.
And then what if it's an emotion that you do want, like joy or compassion or love?
Yeah.
What's the difference? Are you able to fully experience joy or compassion or love? You're not supposed to be attached to it. Because it blunts the emotional experience and positive.
Okay. So that was a good question, because the question is reading a lot, thinking about, talking about a lot, non-attachment, and non-attachment, she understands, in relationships to things that she doesn't really want to be attached to. She likes that practice, but how about all the things that she likes? doesn't non-attachment kind of, that feels a little threatening, doesn't it? Yeah, so that's good. So let me just back up since there are new people here. So non-attachment, if you read Buddhism and the teachings of the Buddha or whatever, you hear a lot about the Buddhism key practice in Buddhism has to do with non-attachment, right? And non-attachment, we could say, stands in opposition to attachment. Right, so we learn when we study Buddhism that attachment is bad and non-attachment is good. And that's true. But having said that, we need to go understand these things very deeply, right? This is why it's important that I've been coming back to what I said earlier. For those of you who have primarily been around Buddhism as something that you have read, this is the function of a teacher. The teacher explains things, so we know what these things really mean and we know how to practice them. So non-attachment is and attachment are very key. So what we learn in our study in Buddhism, sort of a basic principle, is there is what we call phenomena, right? Phenomena means things, right? In a certain sense, everything is a phenomena, right? So there are things that we see. Well, everything we see, like you're all phenomena to me. To my eyes, you're all phenomena. My eyes and everything you see is phenomena to your eyes. Sounds are phenomena. Sounds are phenomena to hearing. Smells are the phenomena that the nose. Right? So you understand? So everything, kind of in our experience, every object is a phenomena, as well as the mind. There is phenomena that the mind is present to. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories. Right? The whole realm of mental. We would say that's mental phenomena. Is that clear? And if you think about what I just said, that's kind of life. Right? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling, perceiving, right? That's the whole realm of all the things that appear to us in life, right? I just want to make sure everybody gets that. Okay, so the key question is, well, if this is the case, right? How does one relate to all to the world of phenomena, right? Because this is life, phenomena. How do I relate? And this is where the Buddha, going back to the Buddha, has taught, that there are because in relationship to phenomena, there either is a positive or negative or neutral. Right, it's either we are attracted to it. It's something positive in that phenomena, like it's a pleasant sound, we like it, or a pleasant sight, or a pleasant thought, or a pleasant emotion. Right, we like that. Right, as a positive, there are lots of things that are negative. Right, and then there are lots of things that are just neutral. We're not positive or negative. Right? Now, what happens is we don't just leave it at that. Do we? We tend to want to move toward things that we like. We want to move away from things that we do like. And we're sort of indifferent to those things we are neutral. Right? So right away, a kind of relaxed, open kind of way of living is becoming a little bit more difficult, because there are some things we're moving toward, and there are some things we're moving away from, and there are some things we're just becoming indifferent to, right? But we don't leave it at that, do we? We not only move toward, but we want to what? We want to hold on to them, don't we? Right? We want the experience to last. We want the relationship to last. We want the object always to stay the way it is, right? So we attach. We hold on. We grasp. In the same way, the things that, that are unpleasant, we're not simply just kind of relaxed about it. We want it what? We want it gone. We don't want it at all. We want to avoid it, right? And so we can see that what began as a fairly simple, open process becomes quite manipulative. Right? We are always trying to hold on to and grab and control the things that we want, we like. We're always pushing away, trying to get rid of, avoiding those things we don't like. And then a lot of things we're just indifferent to. Right? Now, most people would call that normal life. Right? Right? That's normal life. That's what we're all about. You know, how can I get as much as what I want into my life and hold on to it? And how can I get rid of all the things I don't want, all the people, the emotion, and be totally rid of that? And the rest of the stuff, who gives a damn, right? I'm indifferent. So that whole endless process of doing all that, the Buddha, 2,600 years ago, he called that dukkha. He said, that's suffering, right? That is basically a very unsatisfactory way of living. There's no ease in that. There's no openness in that. You're just a lot of work in that, right? You know, anybody's ever tried to control their life or people or situations or their minds have really realized how difficult that is. So the Buddha said, rather than attaching, be non-attached. Now, what is your name?
Courtney.
Courtney, this is the key thing. It's very important because everybody in here is a lay person, right? So it is very important for those of you who read Buddhism to understand that the Buddha taught from the basis of skillfulness and appropriateness. In other words, he made his teachings appropriate to the audience. So when you are talking to an audience, as the Buddha did primarily, we don't even know if primarily, but they're the ones who did the recording. Which is, if you're talking to an audience of monks and nuns, right? Monks and nuns in those days were his celibate followers who only had two robes, who didn't have a permanent dwelling place, who had no possessions other than their bowl and a robe and a few little implements, right? Who every day went begging for their food, so there was no food storage, right? The way you talk to a monk and a nun about how to relate to objects and how you talk to a lay person like ourselves is very different. Is that clear? Because our life is totally involved in the world of things, in the world of relationships. We have jobs, we have clothes, we have hair, we have more than one shirt or dress, you know what I mean? We have bills to pay, right? We have relationships, we have children, we have, right? So it's very different. And so the teachings are very different. So it's very important that when you're reading Buddhism, that if you're reading a teaching the Buddha might have given to celibate renunciate monks and nuns, is a totally inappropriate teaching for people like ourselves, right? So it is not about detachment. This is important. Detachment has a sense of what? Kind of, I'm indifferent. I'm detached. Couldn't care less. Now, if you're in a relationship with someone, that's probably not the best operating principle, is it? Right. I mean, for obvious reasons, but even at the unobvious reasons, if you're practicing detachment, why would you have a relationship? So you wouldn't even go down that road, which is, of course, celibate monks and nuns. They don't go down that road, do they? But we go down that road. So so that is why non-attachment is the practice. Non-attachment is about not about the experience of, it's about the holding on and grasping, right? It's wanting things to always stay the same. By the way, do things always stay the same? No. So the Buddha's teachings on attachment and non-attachment are teachings that help us live in a way of goodness in this life as it really is, right? Because in this life of phenomena, we know that the nature of phenomena is what? It's always changing. Always changing. Nothing is stable. Everything's impermanent, right? I mean, whether things are impermanent nanosecond to nanosecond, or whether things are impermanent year to year, right, or decade to decade, the time frame may be different, but the truth is the same. Things change. Feeling states change. Thoughts change. How many thoughts have you had since you came in this morning? You still having the same exact thought you had when you came in this morning? No. How many thoughts of mind states, memories have come and gone since you've been here? Right. So everything is, the mind is changing moment to moment, we're changing moment to moment, everything is changing moment to moment. Right. So, to learn how to be mindful, to learn how to be present, to learn how to be aware in a very open, non-attached way to everything that arises, internally and externally, is a very sane practice. Right? It's pragmatic. It is a practice and a way of being that clearly relates to the nature of how things really are, which is what? You can't hold on to anything. Anybody ever try to hold on to anything? What happens? What?
You lose it.
Well, but even trying to hold on to it when it's changing right before you produces what in you? Suffering, unhappiness, frustration, anger, right? Nancy talked about anger. Why do we get angry? It's not going our way, right? Right? Because we are into what? Controlling things, right? We want things to go our way. We're attached, right? We're attached to things going our way. But things don't always go our way, do they? So therefore we what? We suffer. We get angry. We get resentful. Right? We get hurt, we get disappointed, we get afraid, we get anxious, all because what? We think the problem is you. But the problem is me and my ignorance in attaching to something that is fundamentally beyond my control. So non-attachment doesn't mean that you can't experience a full range of positive emotions. It actually, non-attachment allows you, makes possible that you can experience a full range of positive emotions without all the things we're now doing that contaminate and destroy happiness. What is it? It is our attachment. And our attachment is to the way we want things to be, but also our attachment is to the way we don't want things to be. Because again, not only are we trying to hold on for dear life to everything we want to always stay the same, right? See, we want all the good things in life, all the good things we like, we'd like that stuff to be permanent, right? And we'd like all the bad stuff to be impermanent. Right, which is what you said, right? You're quite happy with the practice of non-attachment to all the things you're not attached to. No. And you know, one can understand that one would certainly like it that way, wouldn't we? Unfortunately, what happens? The truth is, you know, there are things that come into our life, you know, that are unpleasant. There are things that come into our life that we'd rather not have come into our life. But that is also as normal as, you know, all the positive things. Because everything is changing. Things come and things go. Right? Things develop and things deteriorate. Things are new and things get old. Right? Things are whole and things break. People are one way, and then they're another way. People say one thing, and then they say another thing. Right? People promise to do this, and then they do that. Is that not true? I mean, we laugh, because see, in our moment of sanity, we go, yeah, that is true. And then we leave here and go back to our life, and we just want to control everything and make it go our way, right? So again, this teaching, you know, of non-attachment is a wonderful teachment. It's not the teaching of detachment, right? It allows you to have all the full range of positive emotions, but, you know, does happiness, you know, I sound like a song, does happiness last forever? No, right? Right? You know, if you have children, you know that your children can be a great source of joy to you. But anybody who's had children, especially once they become teenagers, know that your children can be a great source of suffering to you. Right? That's the truth, isn't it? Right? And we know that when we love someone, that can be a wonderful thing. But the truth is also, at some point, we will lose them. Things will change, won't they? And so therefore, that's true too. And when we understand, you know, the full range of life, the full range of the ups and downs and the passings and the coming and goings and the good and the bad, right? And we understand that this is just the way it is. And my challenge, our challenge is always, how do I relate to this? Do I relate to it in a way that causes emotional suffering, afflictive emotions to arise? Right? Or do I relate to it in a way that comes from a sense of well-being, ease, happiness, joy, compassion? So does that clarify it? Well, all right, I'm game. So what's the other 50% that we didn't clarify? Why don't you bring him next time?
So, you might have asked the follow-up to that. So, it's not just being attached to good or bad. Mm-hmm.
How do you generate
a sense of certainty because of relationships and things in our life happen over a period of time, it's not just in the moment. So I guess what our question is how do you really fully commit to feeling what you feel in the moment, whether it be anger or sadness or love or whatever it is, if you're not certain that tomorrow or maybe the next day it will be there? Like, what's the point of committing to something if you have no certainty that 10 minutes from now it will change? How do you How do you generate that sense of certainty in your
life? Oh. You and your husband have interesting discussions. So, good. Good. So the question is, if you're committed to a certain type of love or a certain way or something, and how can you be certain that it will always be there? Is there a certainty that it will always be there?
It will always be there, but if I'm feeling something in the moment,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to feel whatever I want to feel,
right?
How do you fully commit and not hold back to whatever you're feeling in that moment if you don't have any certainty that tomorrow or the next day, like, what's the point of committing to whatever it is if there's no certainty that tomorrow is going to be there? How do you not edit yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, hold on a second. This is getting complicated. I think you got to rein you and your husband in a little bit in your discussions. But it's good that you're thinking about these things. Yeah. So when you, like this morning, today is a new day. I vow to live it in mindfulness. Right. So that's a commitment. Right. And you might say, well, how do you know that's going to happen? And how do I know, right? Well, you don't, do you? All you know is that you've made a commitment. But when you've made a commitment, that gives you a direction in your life, right? It gives you a direction that when you are living in mindfulness, you know that you are and you're fulfilling your commitment. But you also know that when you're not living in mindfulness, you are not fulfilling your commitment, and it gives you the opportunity of getting back on board. Okay? So the certainty is not about how things will be. The certainty is about how I will relate to things. That's the certainty, right? I mean, if you are committed to your husband to living together in harmony, for example, let's say that's your commitment. Is there a certainty that you'll always be in harmony? Absolutely not. Right? Right or wrong?
True.
True. Right. Very difficult for people these days to live in harmony with another human being. That's another Dharma talk. Right. But your commitment to live in harmony, let's say, in your relationship means that whatever arises, right, you will deal with. You'll deal with it how? In the context of wanting to create this harmonious relationship. So you will be cultivating ways of interacting. You'll be cultivating individually personal ways that you can manifest harmony, both individually and as a couple, right? You will be harmonious with one another. Which means you'll be doing many things, right? You'll stop trying to control and manipulate each other. You'll be more accepting, more loving, more understanding, right? More patient. You'll be doing lots of things that create, quote unquote, a harmonious relationship. On the other hand, when things are not harmonious, right? Because you have committed to harmony and you are present to what you're feeling, you will be able to acknowledge one to the other, we are not in harmony. Or I am not in harmony with you, or I don't feel that you're in harmony with me, or I'm experiencing that we're not in harmony with each other. And therefore you will then undergo a practice, whatever you guys do together, that will allow you to, at the same time that you are present to what you're feeling, right? Maybe you're feeling angry or resentful or hurt or all the other things, right? You're present. But your way you are dealing with these things in the context of your relationship is one that facilitates harmony rather than one that facilitates disharmony, right? So if you are angry or resentful at your husband for something he did, you could what? Throw something at him, right? Or you could make an unkind remark. You know what I'm saying? Or you could do something that would exacerbate the disharmony. Right? You could do that, couldn't you? Right. So just because you are feeling something doesn't mean you have to act on it in an unskillful way. Right? So mindfulness of afflictive emotions is not the same thing as like, I can do whatever I want. Right? So you may be mindful that you're angry or resentful, but you will hopefully, because you are practicing in this path, or whatever path you practice on, that you have a way within yourself of dealing with your own afflictive emotions. So that when you bring them to your husband, you bring them in a way that is possible to deal with within the context of harmony. You know, throwing things, whether it's physical objects or whether it's verbal objects, is usually not facilitating of a deepening harmony, is it? No. So you are fully free to be present to what you're feeling, what you're experiencing. But how you express that is in the context of how you, as an individual, and let's say you and your husband, have kind of agreed that this is the way we handle conflict. Does that? So that the certainty, the only certainty you have, is that you and your husband will do your best. But you will be prepared, since you are less than Buddhas, that sometimes you will not be at your best. And so you should have a contingency plan. But, you know, the certainty is not that I will always be happy with you. The certainty is that I want to be, as much as I can, happy with you. But to say it will always be that way is to impose a stricture and a structure on reality, which is dangerous. Dangerous for the individual and dangerous for the relationship. So there is no certainty. You know, even making a commitment, there's no certainty. I mean, if everybody who ever went to a marriage ceremony and heard the vows and commitments people would make, they would think, what? What a world of harmonious relationships. Right, this is a magical land. People say such wonderful things to each other and make such wonderful commitments. But the truth is, you come back a few years later, or a few decades later, and you realize that even with the certainty, the way people make those commitments, it doesn't often work out that way, does it? Sometimes it does, often it doesn't. So that is why you want, if you want a harmonious relationship, you and your husband, you want to have a deep practice. What does that sound, Sam? What? Oh, somebody's out there working? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Just the last remarks. Not a question, but makes me think of the difficult concept of impermanence and how it all relates to what we were just talking about.
Yeah, it's
emotions.
Yeah, well, permanence is. Yeah. What?
How does one cope with that?
How does one cope with that? With impermanence.
Correct. Principles.
Right. Right. Again, it's important to understand that when in Buddhism, when we talk about concepts, might say, of impermanence, they're not concepts, right? Because they are grounded in reality. So it's important that if we are encountering teachings, right, ideas such as impermanence, that we really reflect on them deeply. So they are not just concepts, but we see them as the truth. Truth not like capital T, but truth like, yeah, that's really the way it is. it's a truth. It means it's something that I can see everywhere, and anybody can see everywhere, and not only can those of us who see it, but science says it. I mean, anybody who looks at the nature of phenomena will see impermanence, and we can say, oh, this is not just a concept. This is really what's happening. So then the question is, well, how do you cope with that? You don't cope with it. You either accept it or you don't. You either accept the truth or you don't. If you accept the truth of impermanence, then you are no longer blindsided by it. You are no longer disturbed by it. You are no longer angered or frustrated by it. You are no longer fearful of it. You are no longer hurt or saddened by it. Because you understand what? This is the nature, this is just the way things are. Right? For example, I am impermanent. Right? This body is impermanent. It started out like this, then it got bigger, then it started to shrink. You know, when you're 5 years old, you see a five-year-old looking out at you in the mirror. When you're 50 years old, you'll see a 50-year-old looking at you with you. When you're 100, you'll see a 100-year-old. I mean, that is impermanence. That is just the way it is, right? Bodies are impermanent. They are born, they grow, they deteriorate, and eventually they will decompose. Everything is like that. That's just the nature of things. Individuals are like that. Governments are like that. World systems are like that. The weather is like that. Everything is subject to impermanence because nothing is solid. Everything is made up of causes and conditions. This opens up another whole area of Buddhist teaching. But basically, impermanence is, and the idea that everything is impermanent, please reflect deeply on it. It's easy to say, oh yeah, everything changes. I get it. Right? Except when it happens to us. Then it's a drama. Then it's a big melodrama, right? Because the truth is because we really haven't gone beyond our intellectual understanding. If we have an intellectual understanding but not an experiential, it's not personal. When it's personal, then we really have the power to use these teachings and concepts to liberate us. And please remember the Buddha said, I teach only one thing. I teach the cessation of suffering, the liberation from suffering. I don't teach concepts, I don't teach ideas, I don't teach philosophy. I'm only here to help liberate people from their suffering. Right? So the teachings of impermanence and the meditation on impermanence and the reflection on impermanence is in the service of liberating us from how we suffer. We suffer with impermanence because we want things to be how? We want things to be permanent. We'd like all the good things in our life and all the good people and all the people we love and care about, we'd like them what? To always be healthy, right? To live forever. We'd love to live forever with them, right? No harm come to anyone. And yet the truth is what? We will be parted from everyone we love. They will be parted from us. Everything comes to an end. Right? And that's not a downer. That's a liberator. Because when we get that, then we can live. We can really appreciate the good things in our life. And when you know, you know, the Japanese have a very interesting part of their culture where they appreciate the transitory nature of things. Right. So they love in the spring to go out and look at the fruit trees, like the cherry trees, right, as they blossom. And if you go out there over a few days, you will see them blossom. And you will also see them in a few days begin to wilt. And you begin to see them all fall to the ground and carpet the grass. And then eventually they disappear. And that moment of, that complete moment of the cherry trees having just the beginning and then a full blossoming and then the wilting and then the falling to the ground is the complete cycle, isn't it? And learning to appreciate that whole process is important. But the wonderful thing is when the cherry tree is at its full blossom, you want to be there, don't you? You see, you don't want to be hurrying by on your way somewhere thinking about all the things you got to do today. Right? Because I got a lot of important things to get done today, don't I? I'm the most important person in the world, and all the things I got to do today are the most important things to be done. And my dramas are, and my melodramas are so important, I have to give them my full undivided attention, and I can't notice. I'm too important to notice that the cherry tree is blossoming. That's my child sitting across from me at breakfast. And I didn't look at him or her. I didn't look at the person I live with. I don't even look at the people I work with. I don't stop and look and be present and be appreciative. I'm not appreciative even of my own body, of my own life, of the fact that I'm breathing in this moment. How wonderful. Because I don't know if it'll be like this tomorrow, do I? Do I? No. So to really understand impermanence is to deepen life, is to make life much richer, and keep your priorities straight. Because it's very easy in our society to have really very whacked out kind of priorities. The things that we think are important, the things that we devote so much of our energy to. And we don't notice how much goodness and beauty there is. And we just pass by. Right? We don't taste our food. We don't notice each other. Like that. So reflection on impermanence is a deep practice. Don't just leave it as, oh, everything changes. Yeah, I know. But I want a deep teaching. Impermanence is a deep teaching. And it's worth deeply reflecting on. It will bring great happiness to your life. It is very liberative. Any other questions? Yes?
I wonder if you can share some thoughts about hope or loss of hope.
About
hope.
Hope.
Loss of hope.
Hope. Share some thoughts about hope or loss of hope.
That same kind of hope.
Yeah. What is your name?
Howard.
So what do you mean by hope when you say hope? I mean, what does that mean to you?
Let me just answer this way. I work with people at the very end of their lives. Very end of their lives.
Uh-huh.
And hope is a common source of discussion. What one can hope for, what one has, what maybe you can't hope for.
So what, when they say, when you say hope, what does that mean? Hope.
Most people express it in the context of a future that somehow is not available. I don't have hope that I'll have this disease cured, that I'll be here next year. I can't see what it is I can hope for.
Yeah. So that's, I like that. Yeah. So that's very important, because we know that hope is a term very much bandied about in our society, isn't it? We hope for the future, don't we? We hope things will be different, don't we? I mean, that's very much part of our vernacular. It's funny, in all my years of Buddhist study, I don't know if there is a word of hope in the sense of that. Because Buddhism is very much, as we say, a teaching that is very much about what we can do right now. Right? And when the Buddha was asked about the future, the Buddha said, if you want to know how your future will be, see what you're doing right now. How you're thinking, how you're feeling, how you're acting. Because what you are doing right now in the actions of your body, speech, and mind is creating, are the seeds or the causes of the effects that will manifest in the future. So always in Buddhism, if you were to think about a type of future you wanted, right, you would then focus on how am I living right now? Because how I'm living right now, you know, how I'm thinking, how I'm feeling, how I'm talking, how I'm acting, this, you know, the future just doesn't appear out of nowhere, right? Right. We could say who I am right now, when I mean for everybody, who we are right now, for each of us, we are the culmination of everything we have thought and felt and, you know, experienced in our life. It is culminating right now. You know, people sit in meditation and go, oh, I wish I had a different mind than what I, you know, how did I end up, how does a guy like me end up with a mind like this? Right? You know. Well, you know, if you look at your life and what you have been thinking about and the way you've been acting and feeling and all the mind states you've cultivated over the course of your life, you'll see clearly why your mind is the way it is and why your actions are the way your actions are. And, you know, it's all because of the past is why you're manifesting the way now. Now, if you want to do differently, right, if you want a different future for yourself, then the question is, or if you want to know how is my future going to be, well, I would say, you know, it's a combination of whatever you're carrying from the past and what you're generating in the future. I mean, generating in the present. Put those two together, you have your future. If you want a different future, then you need a different present. And so therefore, dealing with people even at the end of life is always about present, right now. Yeah. Because like we were saying, what's your name again?
Courtney.
Courtney, like we were saying to Courtney, there's no certainty about the future. The only certainty really is right now. In this moment, I have the capacity of generating peace, the capacity of generating love, the capacity of generating understanding, the capacity of generating kindness, the capacity of generating a clear mind. If that's what I want in my future, then I need to generate that right now.
I have something to add. I deal with the terminally ill also, and sometimes I win, and sometimes they make their transition, but their suffering will end. And what I get out of it is I was able to help them.
Yeah. So again, if you are in personally or professionally working with people who are ill, I mean, yeah, the more you're able in the present, right, to keep them comfortable, to give them a sense of security and safety in just learning how to deal with themselves and their minds and their thoughts right now. Right? That is the best way that you can help them move into wherever they're moving. But again, you know, if you're dealing with people who are always thinking about hope, you know, what is that? They're hopeless because their disease may not be cured. But that's the truth, isn't it? But whatever the truth of how things will go in the future, right now that person is alive, aren't they? You're talking with them. Right now, they're alive. The only certainty is, how do you want to be right now? How do you want to be right now? You're alive now, so you're not dead. You're not terminal yet. I mean, again, I think when you're dealing with people, you have to deal with them in the context of the framework. Obviously, the more that you're dealing with people who understand impermanence, who understand you can't control, who understand that everybody dies, that the body is conditioned to disease, there's less of that anger, there's less of that despair, there's less of that frustration that so many of us in the West bring to it, because we are affronted that we have a disease that cannot be cured, right? I mean, just the same way people are affronted by the idea that they're aging, right? They look in the mirror, this shouldn't be happening to me, right? I mean, it's bizarre, it's irrational, right? I mean, everybody gets sick. Does anybody know anybody who's never been sick? Does anybody know anybody who's never died? I mean, it's normal. It's normal to get sick. We are all terminal. Having a body means we have a terminal disease that will one day manifest. And you know, again, it's impermanence. So if you're dealing with people who cannot accept that, who've never accepted it, it certainly would not be the context of a discussion, would it? But again, helping people learn to be present. You know, even people who are terminal, even people who are having uncomfortableness in their body, can learn how to be mindful, can learn how to calm themselves through mindful breathing. Right? I mean, they're all, you know, I mean, that is a common experience. Whatever their conceptual framework is, whatever their religious framework, philosophical framework. So these, many of the techniques that we use are wonderful to work with people who are terminally ill. Again, you know, there are many religious kinds of programs that are based on hope, right? Everything will be good. You'll be in heaven. You'll be reunited with all your love. They're all waiting for you. And if that's the context in which someone has been operating all their life, I would certainly go along with it, right? Because you want them to enter their transition unafraid and as peace. But I think that's why people, those kinds of religious belief systems are very attractive, because they give that kind of hope. But in Buddhism, it's just so different. It's not based on that. It's based on, you know, to know that I have the capacity right now, no matter what's going on, to be at peace. I have right now the capacity, whatever going on, to manifest compassion and kindness to myself and all my caregivers, and right? And you'll notice that with people who are dying. People do it very differently, depending on who they are. So we should, it's 5 of 12, we should stop. Thank you.